activities and human interaction. It's not in a can. Bonjour et welcome to Chat from the Mat, conversation inspirée de yoga with le grand Brian McRae Davis.
You get balanced by not being balanced and having to balance.
Peg Mulqueen and I met at Mont Tremblant, the Wanderlust Festival in Canada. Peg was brought in to teach Ashtanga yoga. Peg Mulqueen began practicing yoga 17 years ago after her kickboxing class, and she would leave before Shavasana because taking a break in life just didn't make sense to her. She started teaching yoga because the regular teacher was pregnant. After that, she began studying yoga sequences, and only then did she look for a teacher training program. 2 years later, she opened up a yoga studio. She emphatically states that this is the wrong way to go about it, now that she knows. But that was her path. When she first began teaching, her main reference for finding yoga sequences came from a book called Ashtanga Yoga, The Essential Step-by-Step Guide to Dynamic Yoga by John Scott. And you'll find a link to it in the show notes. Peg speaks frankly about her frustration with the present yoga system, churning out teachers in packaged programs. She gives a new idea for a business model for yoga studios that could replace the teacher certification program. She talks about the possibility of an ongoing relationship between student and teacher, or studio. People crave knowledge, and that is often why many enter teacher trainings, not because they plan on teaching. This business model is not really new. It's based on the old way of study, one-on-one. Being a yoga teacher is not a great business model, because it's about the people, not about the money. And so many people now think big, and that can be their downfall. Peg encourages teachers to start small. Students care more about relationships. Invest in the people, not in the overhead. Peg explains that Ashtanga is a breathing method, not a physical practice. On a whim, she and her daughter created a magazine called Ashtanga Dispatch. From the magazine, the podcast soon followed with the help of Chris Lucas. There's also a blog that Peg occasionally writes in, and all of these can be found at her website, ashtangadispatch.com. In our conversation, she mentions one of her more controversial blog posts, Why Almost Everything You Learn in Teacher Training is Wrong. And there's a link to that, as well as a link to her website, in the show notes. Also in the conversation, at one point she mentions Samantha Lucas, a woman who practices Ashtanga yoga and is missing the lower part of one leg. You can learn more about her on the Facebook page, which is also linked into the show notes. So thank you for joining me, Brian McRae Davis, for Chats from the Mat, yoga-inspired conversations. I am here with Peg Mulqueen, and we are at Wanderlust Mont Tremblant. Is that how you...
You said it really well. I'm not going to even fix it. I'm not going to even attempt it.
Okay. Well, wherever we are, mm-hmm. It's beautiful Canada. Peg, what are you doing here?
That's a really good question. I'm teaching Ashtanga yoga.
Ashtanga, I've been to a few Wanderlusts, not very many, but as I understand it, they don't normally have Ashtanga. Is that correct?
It's the first year.
Is it really?
I'm super excited. Yeah. I wasn't excited at first. I was actually terrified. Festival and Ashtanga don't actually usually go together. Mm-hmm. And I got schooled, actually. I said, I really don't know if... this is the right setting. Like, I don't think anyone's going to come to Wanderlust for Ashtanga, and definitely not for me. And I remember the person who asked me to do it looked at me and said, I didn't ask you so that you would bring people. I asked you because I felt it would be good for students, that they would get an experience of Ashtanga yoga that they haven't had and they wouldn't get. So it was not for you, it was for them. And I was like, how could I say no to that? Actually, that's what I believe in. That's what I want to do. That's what Ashtanga Dispatch was all about, was bringing Ashtanga yoga to people that would never experience it, or maybe were too scared or intimidated, And so making it accessible, making it inclusive, showing that everyone and everybody can practice Ashtanga yoga, the method. And when she reframed that back to me, I felt like an asshole, first of all. And second, I was humbled and grateful. So I'm really grateful to be here.
That is a great way of framing the conversation. It's not about you. It's, I mean, not in the self-righteous way. It's not about you. It's about them. But the fact that they're not putting on you to make the event happen, and they believe in you, and they feel like there's a need that needs to be filled.
They wanted to bring the method. Yeah. I mean, they were doing it. I mean, a lot of thought goes into putting this festival together. I'm so impressed. I can't even tell you. Like, a lot of thought, a lot of planning, and really paying attention to what would serve students. I mean, there's not, my classes aren't packed. You know, the Ashtanga yoga classes aren't packed. So it's not like they're bringing in some big name, jam packing an auditorium with people or anything like that. It's 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, primary series. And they're really just making this available because they wanted to serve the students. Okay. So kudos for them. I'm impressed.
Okay. Have you been practicing Ashtanga for a while?
I mean, define a while.
Longer than a year.
Longer than a year. Yes. Yes. 9 years.
Ashtanga.
9 years. Ashtanga yoga.
Now, you didn't start off in Ashtanga.
I did not start off in Ashtanga. No, you want to know that story, don't you?
I do.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's see. I gotta go, God, how many years ago did I start practicing? It was a long time ago, maybe 17 years ago. So it wasn't a lot of yoga at that point. It was taught at gyms. Remember, it was like, That was a big deal, right? You went to a yoga in a gym. That's when they started first putting classes there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did kickboxing across the street at the dojo. And somebody said, oh, you should take the yoga class across the street at World Gym. And so I did. And I was like that person that when everyone laid down, I left to go to my kickboxing class. Like, I would just be like, I'm just going to leave now. Shh. And I would tiptoe out. And that was me.
I'll pause for 1 second.
Oh, sure.
I've seen, you know, that happened from time to time. And I'm curious, for you, what was it that made you at that point in the practice decide, I'm going to go and do this other thing now?
Well, I don't really think I saw it as anything more than just some exercises, which is great, which is totally fine. See, mm-hmm. Here's the deal. There's no judgment there. It's a little embarrassing to admit to you right now, but there's no judgment because that's the way most of us start.
Sure.
It's making shapes with our bodies. I just simply had another class that I was going to. So it was it was just a time issue. Okay. And, you know, I didn't really know what taking rest was all about at the end. Actually, I didn't know what taking rest was all about, period.
Right.
Yeah. And and for sure, that would become clear later. But you never know when you're in the moment. You know, you only learn things in retrospect. You don't really learn them when it's happening. It's only when you look back and you're like, oh, yeah, that was me. Like, I didn't rest, period.
So you weren't anti-naps. You just had something else on your schedule.
Always had something else on my schedule at that point. I was also in a PhD program at UVA. I was the director of counseling for a school system. So I was raising 2 small children. Yeah, I had a busy schedule. I had shit to do. Right. I didn't have time to lay around. That was how I began. That was what you would call power yoga. And then, can I just fast forward? Like, it was like literally back then there weren't teacher training programs. I went to a weekend exercise program, and the teacher at the gym was pregnant, and she said, hey, I need somebody to take over this class. Can you do it? Well, I was getting a doctorate in educational leadership. I can teach and I could do the shapes and poses, so I know how to write out a lesson plan. Mm-hmm. I could physically do what we needed, and could use the extra money. Free gym membership? Sure, I'll take it over. So I did it. Weekend workshop, took over the gym thing, and then I started studying it. Well, I have to know. Right now I have to really study. If you're going to teach something, this is like back-ass words, right? You don't ever do this. Don't ever do this. Please don't think I'm ever recommending this. But it was 17 years ago. There wasn't anybody else. There wasn't anybody to teach it. Literally, it wouldn't go on. So I did. 2 years later, I quit my doctorate program. I quit my job and I opened up a yoga studio.
Well, and of course, at that time, there also were not the yoga police to go and tell you you're doing it wrong. We're judging you.
No, I didn't know any better. I didn't know enough to know that it was wrong. I didn't know enough to know anything. I just couldn't really think about it and plan. There was a need. People really loved the class. The class started growing. I actually started feeling differently. And again, I couldn't quantify it or tell you about it till later. Right. Sure. In the moment, I'm just going with it. It's just organic. It seems like the right thing. I mean, you know, not to like bog you down with politics, but like No Child Left Behind was in place and, you know, the schools were changing. It was becoming very test oriented. All the programs, the child centered and people centered programs that I'd worked so hard to put into place were no longer important. Mm-hmm. And yet I'm doing this yoga thing and it seems to be really helping people. Like, it was helping the kids, like teenagers that I'd be working with. We'd be doing breathing exercises. It was helping me. It was helping me.
Now, were you aware that it was helping you?
Yeah, probably. I mean, like I said, I was, and my daughter is sitting in here. I don't know if I'm allowed to do this, but she would probably verify that I definitely changed.
Yes.
She's nodding her head. Yes. Yeah. So she was little at the time, but I was definitely a go, go, go mm-hmm. person. And yeah, things changed for me around that time. Slowed down. Yeah, it was. Yeah. And it needed to.
So that's when you stopped skipping the nap at the end of the yoga class.
Yeah. Once I started teaching it, I knew I had to. Yeah. No, I couldn't.
Okay.
Still wasn't great at it. But. So opened up a yoga studio and then all sorts of different styles after that. Ashtanga yoga, though, when I went for that curriculum, remember when I went to study something to teach because mm-hmm. I didn't know anything? It was Ashtanga yoga that I looked at.
Was that accidental?
No, because it was well written. If you went to the live, went to go get a book, I mean, at that point, there weren't any books either. And so Ashtanga yoga is a method. It's a scientific method. It spoke to me. Education wise, it was laid out. It made sense. It had a methodology, a discipline, a curriculum. I mean, it was everything that spoke to me. So John Scott's book was the first book that I ever picked up. Certified teacher is an amazing, amazing teacher and a good friend now. And it was his book that I studied. And I wasn't going to teach from that, but I definitely used that as my guide. Now, that being said, didn't know any better, right, at that point. As I started to learn more, when I would say Ashtanga yoga to anyone, they would look at me and they would say, oh, you can, it became this like badge, like, oh no, either don't go there, people get hurt, or that's only for teachers. That's only for very experienced people. There was only one Ashtanga yoga studio in DC that there wasn't anything else. I mean, there's like seven now.
Hmm.
So back then there was one. And only if you were a gymnast, did you go there, or a teacher. You had to be like someone special
sure.
to go there. And I remember thinking, damn elitist, you know? And so I was like, I don't want to do that. Like, I don't want to become a part of that kind of group. And then a friend of mine was going to Mysore for the first time to practice with Guruji. And she said, do you want to practice with me in the mornings? Because I have to practice the sequence before I go. And I was like, sure. You know, and then, because then I'm like, still, again, you're always drawn back. Like, I was like, no, I don't want to do that because they're a bunch of elitists. But then she wanted me to practice with her. So we started practicing in the morning. And I remember we got to a pose and she looked at me and she goes, here's where they kick you out. And I was like, really? You're going to travel all the way to India and they'll kick you out? And she's like, oh, if you can't do that, you get kicked out. I'm like, assholes. Not only are they elitists, but they're assholes too. So again, drifted away, didn't want to do it, but kept being brought back because there's something that makes a lot of sense mm-hmm. about the practice. It was the stories. It was the myths. It was, you know, other people's perceptions of experiences that actually now, looking back, I realize No, those weren't true. Nobody kicks you out. I mean, it's not elitist at all. It's a breathing method. It's a beautiful practice, but I didn't know that then. And maybe that's the way I was meant to come at it. Maybe I wouldn't have this philosophy. Maybe I wouldn't be here at Wanderlust if I hadn't had so many bad experiences, you know, in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So many doors closed in my face. So many attempts. I really wanted to practice this from the beginning. It was what made the most sense to me. But time and time again, it just seemed inaccessible and not welcoming.
Now, just to give us some context, when you opened up your studio, when you were going, and up to that point, when you were living, making your way into yoga, you were living in Virginia at the time?
I was.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the studio that you opened up, where was that?
In Leesburg, Virginia.
Okay. That's not near D.C., is it?
It's kind of. It's like 30 minutes outside.
Okay. Is that considered a suburb then?
Yeah, outside suburb. I moved closer to D.C. later. Okay. Yeah.
And when you opened up your studio, were you the only teacher there, or did you bring in other teachers as well?
I mean, literally, this was a little room. This is a whole, even if you want to switch gears in a business of yoga, it was definitely, I learned a lot from that. It was a one room when I first opened it up. It was very community-based. The people that I'd been teaching at the gym, what ended up happening was I couldn't teach as many people that wanted to learn at that point. And now I'm like, I didn't open up a yoga studio because I was going to make money. In fact, I had to sell, just picture this, I had to sell advertising in Clipper magazine to make a living to support the yoga studio that I just understand that I quit a PhD program, the director of counseling for a school system, opened up a yoga studio in a one room nothing and had to sell ads for a discount magazine on the side to support me and my children. That being said, it was lovely. The community came together. They painted my walls.
Oh, wow.
A lot of those students I still keep in touch with, you know, 15 years later. They still come out and visit. They've followed this journey all the way to kind of where I am now. But I got a business partner. And she definitely had some bigger ideas about where she wanted the studio to go. And she was the money end of it and was able to invest a good sum to make it bigger and fancier. And but when you invest a lot of money into overhead like that and you don't increase your student base to match it, you're screwed. So I gave her the business and walked away.
How long were you in the business before you gave it to her?
I can't really remember. I want to say I had it open for a year, 2 years, maybe 2 years.
Okay.
I think I was out within 6 months. Mm-hmm. I literally just gave 50% away. And
looking back on it now, Do you consider that like a good choice, or is that something you regret?
Well, again, look where I am.
Yeah.
These are the things. You don't know it at the time. You know, that's the thing. At the time, I would have said, oh my gosh, my heart was crushed. You know, I had risked my whole career on this. I mean, this was everything to me. I was devastated when it happened and when I walked away.
So it wasn't a comfortable, happy parting of ways. There was some regret, some anxiety about the choice that you were making.
Oh, there's always anxiety about the choices you make, especially when money's involved. But yeah, it was more like, it was heartbreaking. I walked away from a community, but I knew that it wasn't working, and I knew it wasn't going to, and I didn't know how it was going to work going forward. So there's a lot of trust and a lot of faith. And if anything that the yoga has taught me, and that's where it really taught it early on, was that you start to listen to something other than your brain. You know, you start to listen to something else that speaks deeper within you. There's an intuition, a feeling. There's less planning and more, you know it in a different way than you know it up here. You know it in here. And so you make these decisions. And then what ends up happening is you make the decision and then up here in your brain, you start to get, that's where anxiety lives. You know, that's where worry, that's where fear lives, is all there. The story's up there. So it's only been after that I would get, oh my God, what did I just do? In retrospect, if you can just let enough time and space, there's this like quote, Maria Rilke, right? She said, love the questions, because the answers you can't have right now, because you can't live them right now. Love the questions, and one day you'll live your way into the answers. So the answers come when the questions are irrelevant. You don't have the question anymore. But yes, and then you look back. So yeah, it's exactly what needed to happen. Actually, the studio still exists. It is still out there in Leesburg, Virginia, and it does phenomenal.
Now, from you, your relating of the story, it sounds like a lot of your concern about the decision you were making wasn't so much about losing the business, it was about losing the community.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, it wasn't business. It's people. It's always been people for me.
When you opened up the yoga studio, did you have, were you a certified yoga teacher by that point?
Oh my God. Is there a certification for yoga? Is there a real certification for yoga?
Oh, there's, yeah, there's the yoga
people. There's not. There's no certification for yoga. There is in various methods. There is a certification in Iyengar. There is a certification in Ashtanga yoga that comes from India. But I'm not sure what certification there is. There's a registration. Is that what you mean?
Well, yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Would you care to elaborate a little bit more? I'm hearing some opinions that are underneath
you
the surface.
Think? Yeah, because certified says what? I mean, what does it mean to be a certified yoga teacher? I mean, like, I'm literally asking you that.
Okay, so if what it means to be a certified yoga teacher, it means that a organizing body has decided what the requirements are that one must have in order to teach, and that you have satisfied those requirements.
Exactly. And you know what you just said? You have satisfied those requirements. Done. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I got. I got a problem with that. I don't believe, I wrote a blog, it's probably one of my most controversial and most read blogs, and it is why everything you learned in teacher training is wrong.
I can see why that would be controversial.
It was definitely a controversial one, and I stand by those words today. They were snarky. That's my more snarky self that probably wrote them 4 or 5 years ago. And the reason being is that I do know that teacher training programs are the way a lot of businesses have to make their money. I know that this is going to come as a big surprise, but nobody goes into teaching yoga to get rich.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like you said, like it's, you asked me, it's about people, you know, it really, really is. It's not a great business model, yoga teaching. We want people to have daily practices, right?
Yeah.
So it's like the healthcare system. You make your money off the people that pay but don't use it. We have people that we actually want them to use it. We want them to come all the time. So it's like the, you know, they, you don't, that's not how you make money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard when you have a lot of overhead. If you have a yoga studio, there's build outs, there's a lot of expenses, and there's things like that you have to pay for. There's teachers that you have to pay. There's heat. There's, everybody likes fancy things, big desks, you know, computing systems, floors, blah, blah, blah. And it's very expensive.
Now, in a perfect world, where we didn't need this certifying body or registering body, how would you imagine yoga teachers would become known or would find their craft?
Yeah, the old-fashioned way. You study. See, I think that we have it. I don't think teacher training programs. This whole 200-hour, 500-hour, those are just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, you asked my daughter if she was going to teach, if she's teaching. No, she's been practicing yoga for 7 years. She studies every, she wakes up in the morning, she does her chanting, she studies philosophy, she practices, she assists. She doesn't get paid to do a lot of the things she's doing, but this is her life. She's studying these things. It's not a, at the, oh, if you complete this, you get your stamp. It's, you have a teacher. She has me, but she also has another teacher that she'll be studying with for 3 months. But you have this relationship, and it's, it happens more organically. It's like saying, when does your kid get to leave home? You know, you raise them. There's this ongoing relationship that we're losing in the yoga world. We're absolutely losing it. We're putting packages because that's the way we think. We put words around things and we put structure around things and we make them into these packages and we call them 200 hours. Like if you want to write a popular blog, make it 5 steps to like better bodies or whatever, you know, like these are the things that sell.
Yeah.
But I, who the fuck cares about selling? I mean, I don't want to sell yoga. I don't want a teacher out there teaching who went to 200 hours, you know. That's just the tip. You have to like know yourself. You have to really study you before you can reach out to somebody else. And there needs to be an ongoing relationship with another, with someone else. We call that parampara, right? That's built into the Ashtanga yoga method. It's a lineage that you hand down person to person. And that's missing in our yoga world. Now, this being said, I do know that studios need to make money, and I know that you want to talk about business, so I have this idea that I am telling you first. I've never, like, told anybody this, like, in a public way.
Okay. I'm listening.
Why wouldn't we do it like education? Why wouldn't we? Why wouldn't we take our yoga studios? Do you know why, you know why students do teacher trainings? I think. A lot of them enter, and you tell me if I'm wrong, and they say, I don't know if I really want to teach, but all of a sudden, they're interested.
Yeah, they want more knowledge.
They want more knowledge.
Yeah.
And how else are they going to get more knowledge? What do we offer?
Yeah.
Nothing. We offer nothing except 200-hour, 500-hour. And that is doing students such a disservice. I'm not saying take away programs. I'm not saying don't offer teaching opportunities you to teach others. I'm saying why are we wrapping language around it that makes it sound like you've met the qualifications to be a certified yoga teacher? No wonder everyone's confused. No wonder you have all these teachers going out there that don't know how to teach a class. No wonder. Because we've told them that they're now, after 200 hours, you should be able to do it. Mm-hmm. That's not true. That's, like, so mean. I mean, it's like setting them up for failure. It's awful. And then we let them go, and we bring in the next batch. And who do they go back to when they need something? When they're puzzled? When something doesn't go right? Who?
If they don't have that ongoing relationship that you're talking about, there is no one to go back to.
Just go to their 500 hour.
Yeah.
You know, pay another $3,000 and do your 500 hour.
Buy the next package.
Yeah, buy the next package. Right? Why wouldn't we start to offer, like, courses? You know, think about it. Why? And they don't have to be 200 hours, but maybe, like, hey, this semester, I mean, I'm using different language, but it's language that the Western world understands. Let's do it by semesters. And we have, and in grad school, you have somebody that you meet with, that you talk to face to face. That if you're having problems out there, you have internships, you have mentorships, you have courses in different disciplines. You don't like, I mean, I love when people come in and they're like, oh yeah, I did Ashtanga, my teacher training. No, you didn't. You did a day where somebody came in and spoke for 2 hours about it. That is not it. Take a course in it. I think it's so wonderful. Like, I would be all for that. And I actually think it would be really successful. I think students right now, they want to learn. They love the practice. We've been here in the West, we've been doing this now. People want more. They're not in it just for the poses. It's not all about Instagram. I don't believe this. And I'm looking at my classes here at Wanderlust, and they're all ages. They're all abilities. There are people, there's men, there's women, there's everybody in those classes. And I am so stoked.
Now, actually, that's a great segue into this. I do want to come back to the what you talked about, but while we're here, I'm talking about Wanderlust. What? So you're getting a good response. People were liking it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What was their skill level? Would you say that they were, you know, that they were ready for Ashtanga? Because Ashtanga is, you said it is known for being challenging, and it is a challenging practice. I mean, were they in over their head? Were they where they needed to be?
Well, Ashtanga yoga is a breathing method, first and foremost. The shapes are all, they're relevant and irrelevant. Poses, the things that we do on our mat are incredibly important and not important at all. I know, I'm talking in like a little riddle. Yes, I know, it's very confusing. But as long as you can breathe, you can practice. There's a reason things are set up the way they're set up. So I think it is in the way it was laid out. I would never have expected anyone to practice primary series, something that it takes most people 5 years to move through in a way they can breathe. Notice I didn't say master, right? Because there is no mastery of it. But to be able to move through in a way they can breathe comfortably, that's important. Breathing is important. It's a thing. Like everything else really is secondary to that. But breathing is pretty key. But it takes the average person about 5 years to be able to move through the series in a way that they can breathe comfortably. So my number one goal for everybody in the class is to breathe comfortably. I don't teach the poses, the shapes that are so complicated that people will hurt themselves. I do call them. I do count them. But I don't teach them. And the reason I don't teach them is that if I taught them, the expectation would be that students would do them. There's a little mountain there in the middle of primary series. We do let people watch. Megan and I will do the mountain. We call it the mountain because it's super hard. You know, legs go behind your head and like, you know, you get your body all twisted up. And I think it's inspiring. And so what I say is, this is not to intimidate you. Hopefully it's to inspire you, but also to save you from from even attempting this part. It'll take us a few minutes and you're to breathe with us because it's a breathing practice. When I count and I say inhale here, exhale here, you breathe with us. And I think that that's really nice. You know, the first way that you learn, the best way to learn is experience. But the second way is visually. And that's just based on education, you know, and the best way, the way you learn the most is experience. And the second way is visual. So they have the second way.
I had an Ashtanga teacher in Asheville, North Carolina, named Jason Brodsky, and he taught a style. He called it Ashtanga for everyone. And his one of his little part of his little speech in the beginning was to say, your job is to breathe. I'm here to try and distract you from that. And you are not to be distracted from the breathing.
That's a really lovely way. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's great. And in fact, that's what we would say about the practice itself, is that it makes it more complicated and harder to breathe. But the breath is not what you want to sacrifice. And that's how you can tell when there's integration of the yoga practice, is when you can breathe. Free breathing with sound, we call it. There's a mindfulness about it. But there's also some freedom about it. It's not a, you know, holding or straining or any of that. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen, but we're not going for that.
All right. So to go back to what we were talking about before with the yoga education system in America, and just to play the devil's advocate for a moment, you know, in the traditional yoga student teacher relationship, the student would go and live at the master's house for a decade or whatever. The parents would come and provide gifts to the master to, in some ways, pay for that student to be there. And the student would provide services like cleaning and taking care of the master, and in return would get some of these experiences.
You listen to this, Megan? That's what she does. I mean, she cooks for me. She's like...
Perfect.
See, I'm all for it. Yeah.
But I mean, the challenge would be then, as I see it, that model, I have a hard time seeing that model translating to the U.S., to the Western world.
Ah, but it already is. It already is. It starts in the family. It starts, and it is already happening. You think Megan's the only, you know, adult-aged child now that is practicing yoga, that learned it from their parents, that followed their parents? Oh, no, it's been around long enough that it starts in the family first. Mm-hmm. So it is. It's a natural progression. The mother, the father, first teachers. She's now, I just said to you, like, she's been with me all this time. She's now going to be studying with a teacher in Australia for 3 months. And the program that she's going to be a part of is a three-year program. 3 years, 3 months at a time each year. And you commit to it. And with that one person, you know how many people? There's like 10 people.
Really?
Yeah. It's so, and this is with a teacher who's been practicing for 38 years.
Wow.
Yeah. You asked me if I was a certified, or like, I'm not even authorized. Like, I'm embarrassed to even say that I'm teaching Ashtanga yoga here. You know, I don't have even a little bit of the experience. You know, I have such a fraction. They say beginner for the first at least 10 years, and not to even teach, you know, the first 10 years. So, yeah.
You may find the yoga police knocking on your door when you get home.
No, no. Trot knows now. He's even done the podcast. No. I mean, you do things from the heart. Sometimes you do things because there isn't anyone else. Mm-hmm. You know? You do things from the heart, with sincerity and devotion, and then you pray you don't hurt anyone. No, but I mean, for real, like, sincerity and devotion, those are two key things. And you share whatever you share from those places, the experience that comes with sincerity and devotion. And sometimes there's no other choice. But we have choices now in lots of ways. And that doesn't mean, like, if you're in a small town and you know, people apologize all the time. Like, we heard it this morning. Your friend, he said, I learned it. I've been learning from videos. Well, there isn't anyone else. Of course. That's okay. You know, I'm so happy that there are videos out there that can look to, that'll bring you more interested, that brought him into a class this morning. And maybe when they leave there, I get a lot of notes from people that left Wanderlust that are now looking for Mysore teachers. Hmm. Because I tell them that this is a practice that's taught one-on-one. You go find a teacher, build a relationship, and you learn it that way. Because they can look at you like, your body's different than my body. You're going to move in a different way than I move. You know?
Yeah.
There's so many different factors. Like, to teach a set of poses to a big group of people, you know, you got to, like, go with what's not going to hurt people. You know, like, there's 5% of the people, maybe actually 1% of the people, if you tell them to lift their head and look up, it's going to hurt their neck. So you tell everyone now in an entire class to look straight ahead.
Right.
Right? But no, but if you taught one-on-one, you'd get that person, they'd say, oh, that doesn't feel good. And you'd say, well, let's change that up so that it doesn't bring you pain. What if you look here? What if you do this? Oh, yeah, that doesn't hurt. Awesome. You do that.
So you teach modifications in your Ashtanga class,
or variations? That's not even a variation. There isn't, people think that Ashtanga yoga is one way. That is bullshit. Because if you teach a bunch, I mean, I've taught people who, I have one student who has a rod in her spine. From here down to here. Do you think her back doesn't flex?
No.
No. What is she kicked out? Like, she can't do it? Nope, sorry. You know, I'm 51. Boy, I'm getting to be about that age. They can kick me out at a certain age. I mean, no. There's a teacher out there who lost a limb. She has an amputation on one of her legs. You should look her up. Her name is Samantha Lucas. She's amazing. She's out there doing primary series. She just recorded herself. You should see her practice. We were with another gal in Stanford. She had broken her ankle right before Sherratt got there. She did the standing postures, laying down. No, you do what's necessary. Somebody's pregnant this morning. No, it's taught to people. We don't teach poses. We teach people.
That's nice to hear. That's great. And I don't know where the disconnect has come. If it's the students that have made certain assumptions based on what they see, if it's the teachers that get somewhat dogmatic in their approach to things. Mm-hmm. But at some point, I think that Ashtanga, as you mentioned, has a reputation.
Oh, sure.
And not justified all the time, but there is that.
That's why you need a relationship.
Yes.
I mean, honestly, that's why you need. Like, I wouldn't. The way I would speak to somebody I knew really well would be kind of like the way I'm speaking to you. But even though we just met. But but when a class comes in and I don't know them. I don't know what their history is. I don't know what they've walked in the room with. I'm not going to beat them over the head. You know?
That's great to hear.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know them well enough, and they don't know me well enough. We have to build a relationship.
And it just occurred to me that we've gone on the... You and I are very familiar with the language that we're using, but there may be some people listening. Would you give maybe a two-minute history of how Ashtanga came to being? And be as broad or as detailed as you
like. Oh, man. Okay. So, Krishnamacharya, who was the teacher of Pattabhi Joyce, Iyengar, Desikachar, right? That was... his father. Indra Devi, there's other students, but Krishnamacharya kind of came from there. Whether it was on banana leaves, what kind of leaves?
Is it banyan?
Tree leaves, whether it was all written down there, whether it came from the British gymnastics, I don't know. But I'm going to say that Pattabhi Joyce Guruji taught, Krishnamacharya was his teacher. He left his family to go study with Krishnamacharya. He was a strong student, a star student, and he continued to teach what his teacher taught him. And it was called the Ashtanga Yoga Research Institute. Mm-hmm. So there have been some changes along the way, but they're not huge changes. But it was a methodology. So the difference between a method and a style, and why Ashtanga Yoga is a method, and Iyengar is a method, right? And there's some talk, and I don't mean to go back, but the way Krishna, it's funny to see, like, oh, how did Iyengar become so different than Pattabhi Joyce when they had the same teacher? Because we're different. We're all different. I'm imagining that Krishnamacharya changed also as he, as a teacher, mm-hmm. as he got older. I think he was much different with, his son than he may have been, earlier on. So you have to remember that this is a living, breathing tradition that grows and makes shifts as we do. And who knows whether it's the person who's teaching or the students themselves. I don't know. But yes, they both, the way they received their teachings became very different because they were two different people. And I'm just going to use them because I think those are the ones that everybody kind of knows the best. Pattabhi was teaching in Mysore and he continued to teach. Westerners found him and they, I can't imagine going to India back when they all went, but hearing their stories is really cool. It was definitely like horse and pony kind of thing and had to go find him. And,
really?
Would spend a year, sometimes 3 months. And, David Williams, I think maybe brought him over to the, I can't really remember, mm-hmm. but some of those guys started coming over. Tim Miller, they started coming back and then Guruji would tell them to teach and they started teaching and they brought Guruji over and, I don't know. So that's kind of like how it started to grow, and now his grandson, Sherratt, Guruji's Pattabhi Joyce passed away, and Sherratt Joyce now is the keeper of that lineage in Mysore, and it still continues, and it's really grown worldwide, and it's pretty amazing, and it's the same language. People say, well, it's changed over the years, and yeah, there's been some shifts and things like that, but it's always been a breathing method. Always go read Yoga Mala. Guruji like very specifically talks about the inhales and the exhales and where they are and why they're there and what, how the postures help, you know, like what's therapeutic about this. And even in there, it says, have a teacher, and it says not all, Guruji says this, and I'm really loosely quoting, but not all postures are good for all people. Like, get a good teacher. You know, so there's get, you know, you want an experienced teacher to kind of know. So he kind of puts it out there because it was always taught one-on-one. In fact, lead classes didn't come till later.
Really?
Yeah, I think this is like a story time, but I think what he realizes, like, they didn't know he was counting. When he said Akam, Dve, you know, Akam inhale, Dve exhale, I mean, these guys didn't know that was counting, right? So, like, they thought it was, like, names of the poses, like, names of the shapes or whatever. And then I think the way John Scott says is Lino watched Guruji teaching a lead class, and he came back, he was like, he's counting. That's the, like, exotic thing he's doing. He's counting. But, and I think so he started teaching more counted classes because, A, it's really important that you know that vinyasa, that the inhales and the exhales, the way they're placed with the movements, they give the movement shape and direction and texture, you know? So it's important, you know, when you jump forward from downward dog, you know, that's an inhale. It's an inhale. You know, it's important. A lot of people really? Do it on an exhale. I know. A lot of people do it on no breath or an exhale, but it's an inhale.
Yeah, try it that way now. Yeah. Just see how it feels. It
definitely will change things up. But okay. He was very specific. It was prescribed. So think about the words I'm using. Method, prescription. There's a reason for all of those. He details them in the book Yoga Mala that he wrote with the help of Eddie Stern.
Okay. So just to, if you would just go back and clarify, the difference between a method and a style is...
Oh, yes. A method is something that has been practiced for hundreds of years, that with many, many, many people, it is something that has been studied and experienced by masses that makes it a method. You know, something that has helped people. Many people. You have to have time. You have to have numbers to make it a method. A style is a personal flair. A lot of styles will have, you know, I'm going to stop myself.
I know.
So that you don't have to edit anything out.
We're getting into dangerous territory where you could start to classify certain ways of
practicing. I wasn't even going to do that. But I remember when it was when it was almost encouraged to put your personal flair on the way you teach. You know, like peg style. I don't want to teach pegs yoga. You know, you're not there to get an experience of peg. You're there to get an experience of you. They're not even here. I tell students, they're not even here to get an experience of Ashtanga yoga. You're here. Yoga is your experience of you. And this is a tool. This is a tool to help you experience yourself. Not me. I'm the last person you want to experience. I want to take myself out of it.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think a lot of teachers go into it and say, in my past, I've had this experience, and now I want to make sure my students have my experience.
Right.
And it's really unfortunate when that happens.
But it's encouraged a little bit because, you know, everybody's got to make a name. You know, you got to have your take on it. Your... Mm-hmm.
My trademark style.
Your shtick. Yeah. Yeah, your trademark style. Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to your story. You left the studio in Leesburg, Virginia.
Yeah.
And how did your yoga experience, life, business change? Where did it evolve to?
I wish I could tell you that I wrote things down on paper and that I planned everything out. I absolutely did not. Everything is in retrospect. I just knew I wanted to still teach. And so I just started all over again and started, teaching in a Pilates studio. Like, I just rented out space. Eventually, just things continue to grow as you do. And I think sometimes if we just let things grow organically, where you felt comfortable, at that point, I felt comfortable 1 or 2 days a week teaching. I didn't care how many people came. And I just kind of grew from there. Things happened. You can call it luck, but I believe in synchronicity. You know, Carl Jung calls it synchronicity. When you're really present to everything that's happening, there's a flow to the way your life works. It's not luck. It's not coincidence. It's when you're in sync, you know, with the flow of your life, with life. You know, we're not separate from our environment. So as I grew. And people came. It wasn't a business plan. You know what I mean? Like, I could say I was really lucky. You know, I started writing for Yoga Journal. That was really fun and exposed me to lots of people. I got to teach at the White House with a great group of people for 8 years, you know, during the Easter egg roll. I mean, I've like met so many amazing, wonderful people through this practice that has also expanded the amount of people that I've been able to reach or connect with. So, but it wasn't like anything I wrote on paper. I think it was just really being present and just going with that. And that takes a lot of patience and it takes a lot of faith. And that's something that we don't have an abundance of.
Either one.
No, yeah. Really, not when we start putting together packages and at the end you can get a certificate, yeah. You know, then all of a sudden we have demands and we have expectations, and expectations kills both faith and patience.
Yeah. And I guess if you have an expectation, it also narrows your vision.
Sure does.
You only are only open to that one thing or that group of things, and you miss opportunities.
Yeah, you don't know. And I'm not saying that my husband would get mad at me. He'd be like, you know, you have to have goals, you have to have, you know. And I'm not saying that it's not good to have aspirations or, you know, goals or things like that, but you need to be open. You need to keep staying open. So sure, like studying, practicing and studying, yeah, you continue, but you don't make this, you make it so specific, like, you know, 200, 500, this is what I'm going to get, and this is what I'm going to do after, and this is, you lose, you miss so much.
If you don't find yourself making progress towards your goal, you feel like you're failing.
Totally. Yeah, it's just really unfortunate. And I know it feels vague and there's some anxiety. And certainly I can say my daughter probably has felt that way. You know, I've always said, you know, what am I supposed to do? And I say, I don't know. It looks like you're doing just great. And there are sometimes she's wanted me to be more specific and tell me what I'm supposed to do now. And like, should I go to grad school? And I don't know. I just know that when things feel right, and if I said, you're doing all the right things, you know, you have wonderful practices in place. You're doing all the right things. You keep a daily practice. You will know when you know. Mm-hmm. Keep doing all the things that you're supposed to do, and you will know when you know.
So you started teaching classes here and there.
Oh yeah, yeah. And then it just.
And then you did some.
Oh, when I went did Ashtanga.
You left the yoga studio. You started doing some classes, teaching classes here and there. Wasn't really just sort of keeping up with it, maintaining. You also, it sounds like in that time frame, you also started writing for the Yoga Journal.
I started writing for Yoga Journal. Well, maybe later. I don't remember when all things happened. Yeah. Just things kind of just continued to grow. And when I moved to DC, I think the yoga scene in DC was kind of exploding around that time too. Mm-hmm. Connected with just great people in the city and outside of the... Yeah, and that wasn't even like anything in DC. That was like friends outside of DC. Yeah, it was just great. And that's actually how I met my producer and editor for the Ashtanga Dispatch podcast.
Okay, actually, that's great. Let's go into Ashtanga Dispatch. What exactly is that?
I know. What exactly is that? Okay, Ashtanga Dispatch, very quickly, in the city, I did know, I'd fallen in love with the practice. I drank the Kool-Aid. It was amazing. You know, I was able now to have some real experience, not just listen to stories of others. And I knew I really wanted to share it. Very enthusiastic. people were not open to it. It was definitely not, it was seen as, again, only for certain people, rule-oriented, too strict, dogmatic.
Now, were you getting resistance outside of the Ashtanga community or within it?
There wasn't an Ashtanga community, really. Okay. I mean, there wasn't. I mean, DC's yoga community exploded. The Ashtanga yoga community had not. Hmm. So my friend Jen decided she was going to start teaching. And she was reluctant because her practice isn't pretty important. And when you decide to be a Mysore teacher, you get every morning you teach and every morning you practice. And it is a very big commitment. Huge. I mean, you get up at 4 o'clock, 3:30 in the morning. You practice and then you teach for hours. This is a big deal. Wow. I mean, and she'd been practicing for over a decade. Very experienced and amazing. Not unsurprisingly, a lot of yoga teachers aren't super interested in marketing and doing things like that, right? They're like, they're teachers. They're real teachers. They love teaching. They don't love the business stuff. At this point, I'm more like, I could do that, but I don't want to get up every morning. And I still don't do it. You ask me if I have a daily program. I do not. I am in awe of those people that teach Mysore. I am not worthy. So I said I would help her. You know, like, I'd be the background. Like, I'd be the helper. Like, I'd do Sundays, you know. I like to call myself dad. I was the fun one. She was the daily person. She's mom. I'm dad. So we got together and we're like, okay, people are scared. They don't want to come. So how are we going to do this? We should give ourselves a name. She said, what about Ashtanga Dispatch? I was like, what does dispatch mean? She's like, you know, send the word out. I was like, okay, let's do that. We made a couple silly videos. We put them up on YouTube and then shared them on Facebook. And we only did this for DC. This was all we were doing it for. You know, I taught Rocket, which is fun because it was handstands. And I would like teach Rocket, which is a variation of Ashtanga. It's like Ashtanga, you know, without all the really hard poses and a lot of handstands, you know, so it like fit right in. Mm-hmm. And I would say, oh, but if you want to learn this, you'd have to go to Mysore. Oh, but if you want to learn this, yeah, too bad. We can't do this because you can only learn those things if you... You know, so it started feeding people into that. They were like, wait, there's more and you can't teach it here. I want to go there, you know. So we started doing these funny videos. The internet took over.
Really?
Yeah. Like, it wasn't just growing the Mysore program. Jens, people were writing me outside the city and like in the UK and Australia. And swear to God, like, people were like, wow, this seems welcoming, accepting. So the idea of Ashtanga yoga that everyone was welcome was appealing, not just to the Washington, D.C. crowd. So Jen started was teaching her program. And then Megan is in her last year of college and she was in a graphic design. She's a photography major and she was doing a graphic design course and she had just created a magazine and she said, you know, mom, we should do an Ashtanga Dispatch magazine. And I was like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I get to spend more time with my daughter. Like, this will be fun, right?
Right.
Okay. It was really hard. It was really hard to do a magazine. We did do it. And I mean, it was good. It was really good. It was that first magazine and it went everywhere.
Really?
The orders we got, the Netherlands, Japan.
So the only way to get a copy of the magazine was to order it from you. It wasn't on display anyplace, or was it?
No, it was just like to order from us. And like, we're like shipping. We're like just two of us like on a computer, like doing, we didn't even have stamps.com at that point. It was just like, I don't know. It was hard. We were making it up as we went along, you know, but I couldn't believe like every state in the U.S., outside the U.S. And so we had to do another and we did. And then we just did our third and you would think the U.S. is not the majority of where they go. It is global.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if you've heard, but print is dead.
It's bullshit.
So, I mean, I'm sort of baffled. This is amazing because everyone says, you know, if you want to be successful, you get on the internet. You first of all, you have to have a big Instagram account, and you're saying that's not true. And then you're saying you had a magazine. You had a magazine that was globally outreaching. How did you do that?
Well, so I was going to make the third one online, and my husband, he's so old school. He's like balked, and he's like, don't. And everybody else did too.
Really?
People balked. They're like, no, we do have the first one online now because I can't bear to print anymore. I mean, these are on it. Do you see any ads in there?
No.
No, that's right. We don't put ads in them.
Really?
No. No, this is a magazine. It's a real magazine. It has real articles. It has real artwork. It is not a publication to house. I'm not sponsored by anyone. Specifically not sponsored. My podcast is not sponsored by anybody. I don't want advertisers. And that makes it worthwhile that it's not something that, yeah, print is dead because what are we feeding people again? Sorry.
No, it's okay. No, that's good. I mean, of course, I'm trying to rile you up a little bit. But I am, and if I can just lower the conversation a little bit to the details. You know,
yeah.
If you have someone that's in yoga that's trying to make a living at it, that's trying to put food on the table, and that's trying to pay the rent or their mortgage, if you don't mind me asking, I don't want to know the details, the numbers, but is it, this magazine that you made and the podcast that you're doing, is it providing income to you and your family?
All right, so let's go back to that. First of all, the magazines, yes. They are viable.
Okay, great.
It was a huge risk to make. Would I suggest that somebody go out and do that? No, it was a huge risk that I was able to make.
Perfect.
And I have a community that supported it. But like I said, I listened. It wasn't a business plan. Do you know what my biggest advice would be? Start small. Stop thinking so big. Everybody wants how much you spend $2,000 on a desk for your studio. Is it worth it? Do students really care? Do they? I don't think so. I think they care about relationships too. I think that we keep wanting to invest in real estate and in things. Invest in people. To teach yoga doesn't require a lot. We practice right here in this hotel room.
Hmm.
We lay out our mats. When I started small, you want to know when I was the most viable when I had the studio? When it was that little room that was carpeted, hand-painted by all the students that would come in and just like we made it this wild orange color. And it was packed all the time. And it felt like home. Like it was not the prettiest building. I think there was a tattoo parlor downstairs. And that was it. Like you want to invest in people, not in overhead. And so we think that we need all these fancy things all the time, you know? And you just don't. And I played around with like wanting sponsors and, you know, because I was afraid, because it was a big investment in a lot of things. And,
sure. Share the risk.
Yeah. Share the risk. But if you really believe sincerity and devotion, if you believe that what you're doing is helping others, is something good, if you have that faith, you go with that.
There's two things that I think are really valuable that you just said that I'd like to just to reiterate. One is focusing on the community, mm-hmm. and the other is starting small. And I feel like both of those things get forgotten a lot these days.
They really do. But again, it's the expectations, isn't it? Oh, I went to this really pretty studio and it like had, you know, these awesome artwork on the or great floors or, you know.
Handcrafted candles.
Yeah, when you walk out of a class, really, think of the last great class you went to. Do you know what was in that studio? Did you walk out and go, man, you know, that floor was awesome? No, what you talked about the teacher.
Yeah.
It was that person that was there. They saw me.
No one says, I had a very mediocre class. Oh, but the wall decorations were amazing.
I'm so going back.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No. And we forget that and we lose touch with that. And if you go with that, then you're making all the right investments.
Okay. How did the podcast happen?
Wasn't my fault. Chris Lucas, my dear friend and an amazing editor-producer, called me after I did the first magazine. He was like, what's this? He doesn't practice Ashtanga. Chris should practice, but he doesn't. I'm still working on it. But he's like, this Ashtanga Dispatch, it's really interesting to me. And it's like, really, you know, anyway. And he goes, you should do a podcast. And I said, do people still listen to those?
They buy magazines.
Yeah, I know, right? So you thought print was dead. I'm like, people still listen to those? And he goes, have you heard of Serial? And that was like the big one that it was making its resurgence. And I was like, no. And he goes, yes, people still listen. People are listening to them, yes. And there's no chat like we're doing right now. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are practice, you know, podcasts.
Right.
You know, you can follow along. And it was his idea. He said, how about, will you do three with me? Let's just do three and see what happens. And I love him. I invest in people. I trust him. We have a wonderful relationship. And he's a beautiful person. And I said, okay. And we did three. And we just never said we were stopping. We just kept going. We made the decision not to have sponsors. We do have Patreon. So we... people can support the podcast through patreon.com / Ashtanga Dispatch. And we do offer bonus for those students who support the podcast. They often get the podcast first. They get copies of the online magazines. The community supports us. And people are so generous. I mean, they're just so loving and so generous with the magazine as well. Yeah, I mean, whether you can make a living on it, yeah, probably not. But when I get the letters from people, the emails from people that live in really remote places that will never study with maybe a John Scott, you know, I'm going to interview Mark Darby on Monday. You know, these teachers who are steeped in experience and just a wealth of knowledge. Sharat in Mysore. I mean, how many people are going to get to go travel to India? Yeah. And they can't. And so, or they have families, right? Or expenses. It's expensive to travel and to go learn. But the fact that they can make dinner for their kids or drive to work and be listening and be hearing, you know, that knowledge, that learning, that they're able to receive that in that way, that's worth it to me. So I wouldn't say the podcast is incredibly viable. And I think Chris does way more work than I do, but he does it for the same reason. For the same reason.
Okay. And I believe you mentioned in passing that you have a blog as well.
Yeah.
Is that something that you keep up on?
Yeah, I should be more regular about it, but everything's on ashtangadispatch.com. Okay. Everything.
And do you, I asked you briefly before we started recording about your, what your teaching is like, and you said you don't teach locally, you don't have a studio, you teach locally now, you're a travel teacher.
I only travel.
How often are you, in a year, how often are you out traveling teaching?
I try to limit it to once a month.
Okay.
It's just hard on me to travel too much, and I only go to small communities.
Really?
Yeah. I don't go to any. If you have a big trust of traveling teachers, I won't go.
Okay.
Because you already have enough. Yeah. To me, I'd rather visit the studios and the communities. There are a lot of people out there, a lot of Mysore communities that are trying to continue. They're trying to hold things down. These are, a lot of them are moms, working people, and they can't get out there. They have a community there that wants to get together. I actually travel to those communities for the teacher to support them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard. They can't get out and they don't have anybody to come in. And so I would rather connect with them, build relationships with those teachers and come in to support them. For that reason, I would rather save my energy and invest it there once a month to go visit a community like that rather than join some circuit. And
okay.
There's enough people doing that anyway.
There are a lot of them. That's mm-hmm. for sure. Do you know how Wanderlust found you? Any idea?
No.
I'm just curious.
I think my friend Ross Rayburn may have, I think they may have been looking for an Ashtanga yoga teacher. And my friend Isabel, who's now my friend, who I didn't know then, she was looking for an Ashtanga yoga teacher. She talked to my friend Ross. Ross recommended me. She wrote me. I was in Mysore, India at the time. And she said, do you ever come out to LA? And I'm like, no, but I'm going to Sacramento. Is that close? Because that's how good my geography is. And she's like, no, that's 8 hours away. She ended up actually the place, again, synchronicity. She said, but wait, I have a good friend who owns a studio there. If you're going to Sacramento, you should go to his studio. Same studio.
Oh, really?
That's the studio I was going to. Nice. She drove up. She did the weekend workshop. She said, please. She didn't ask me that. We talked about it then. And I said, oh, I don't know. You know, I'm not really a festival person. I am more one-on-one. Big groups scare me. I'm a little scared of crowds. And so she didn't ask me then, but then she came to the retreat in Bozeman, Montana that we did with David Kyle. And it was that week she asked me. Mm-hmm. She knew that it was relationships. We had a relationship. Then I trusted her. And then, yes. So.
All right. So we're just going to start to wrap things up. And as we do, I just want to ask you a couple questions. And so if we can shift the focus primarily towards people that are looking to make a business either within yoga or related to yoga, people that get very passionate about this sort of thing and are trying to find a way to make it both emotionally sustainable and financially sustainable, which is, you know, the challenge to get both. It seems like you can get one or the other. And so do you, given your pretty varied experience in a bunch of different avenues from writing to teaching to studio ownership to blogging, podcasting, is there anything that you could suggest besides the things you already have, such as, you know, focusing on community, anything else that you would suggest to people?
Just because you build it doesn't mean they'll come. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be the bearer of bad news. Oh, but I'm going to be the bearer of bad news. If you're working with community, you're doing something for community. You can't be doing it for you. I'm sorry. You just can't. You can't be just because I want to teach yoga and I want to have a studio means that it's going to be viable and sustainable. If you don't care and you're passionate about it, awesome. But there are so many underserved places. If you have a lot of passion and love for the practice and believe you can help people, then go where you can help people. Then do that. And you should. There are a lot of underserved places that really could use somebody with that kind of passion and love. Not everybody needs to make a business out of it. I'm sorry. I just don't think that that's a necessary thing. But if love and passion is driving you to share, do it. With people that need it. You know? Not enough people go into homeless shelters or women's shelters. They just don't. Find and have patience. We all have to find our own voice. You can't know your voice in 200 hours. You can't know who, you know, you want me to talk in marketing terms? Know your audience, right? Your audience. And that's great. And that works too. Maybe that'll work for people that are listening. But to me, it's who are the people who need me? Those are the people I'm going to. How do I know that I'm not going to go to the big venues? And by the way, don't think that going to small communities doesn't support you in a wonderful way. It does. But they treat you wonderfully. Are you kidding? They're like so grateful to have somebody come, you know? And it's actually not expensive. Like when I go visit a small community, I stay in their home. We make things like as inexpensive as possible. We get very intimate. I don't have to like market myself because I just go to the same places pretty much year after year. And we have this growing relationship. Don't be afraid to invest in people and have the patience to see where your fit is. Don't build something. Don't force something that because you have some goal of making a business. It's like the horse before the cart kind of thing, you know? find where it is that you're needed. And then making a living, it happens. It just does. I know. I hope my husband doesn't listen to this, because he really seriously is going to think, he's going to be like, oh, because I'm not being concrete, and I know. But I do believe it. I've lived it. I'm just sorry. I've lived this. And so I can tell you, based on my experience and looking to others, when we let go of those outside expectations, when we let things be what they are, it works. But you only know it in retrospect. You don't know it at the time. So look to see where you're needed. Serve where you're needed. Build where the need is. And grow in that way.
You have a lot going on that's yoga related in your life, from the podcast, the magazine, the blog, the teaching. Are you enjoying that much varied energy output?
Yeah, because I told you, what don't I do? I don't teach in my own home. I don't teach in Bozeman, Montana. People write a lot and they ask, and a lot of the month is just a very quiet, just me practicing my daughter there in the morning. And then we go hiking during the day and we keep it. There's got to be a balance, right? So all that energy output, there needs to be input. And so you learn that you carve out very private spaces to keep yourself grounded. And I wasn't always good at that. By the way, you don't get balanced by being balanced. So there are many years spent imbalanced to find that balance. You get balanced by not being balanced and having to balance, right? Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying?
When you realize you're imbalanced, right. You try and find.
That's how you find it. So it's always like, there's always some movement there. There's always some months where I'm like, oh, it's too much or maybe not enough. You know, like there's always some movement in and out, and different seasons make a difference. You know, different times of the year, it's easier to give out, and different times of the year you need to bring back in. But I do not teach in my own home. So those are kind of spaces for me that I take and get quiet.
Two more questions.
Mm-hmm.
Do you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
An extrovert.
Really?
But more an introvert lately. I know. Well, you're asking. So, you know, it's like Myers-Briggs, right? Extrovert, introvert is where everybody goes with it. But extroverts get their energy from others. Mm-hmm. Introverts get their energy from being alone. I actually do get my energy from being with others. Just too many others, it's hard for me to be myself. Mm-hmm. So that's all. I mean, like, I think people misunderstand. I am an extrovert in the fact that I do receive energy from other people, but I'm just scared of crowds. So then,
interesting that we find you here at Wanderlust.
Exactly, right? That was the reason why. I was like, I was saying, oh, I don't think Ashtanga and Wander, you know, in a festival. Really, it was like, I was scared as hell.
So you're saying, I don't think Ashtanga and Wanderlust, or Ashtanga and festivals work out. What you're saying is, really, Peg and festivals don't really, I don't know if they...
Oh, it was Peg. Oh, it was totally Peg. And that was why I said I got schooled.
Yeah.
And it was Isabel who said to me, I didn't ask you, because I thought you were going to try. I wasn't doing it for a marketing. Like, this was because I genuinely believe. And I was like, yeah, I can face my own fears.
So then the last question, how would you define yoga?
Your experience of yourself. Self with a big S.
Okay.
Yes.
For people that want to learn more about you, want to try and find you, how can they get in touch with you?
AshtangaDispatch.com.
And that would be how they'd find the magazine, find the podcast, find the blog, teaching schedule. Would that be on there?
Everything.
As well? Everything. AshtangaDispatch.com. Social media as well, or you just stick with the website?
Oh, no, I'm on social media too. Remember, I'm like 2 days behind on that Instagram challenge that I've got to go photograph. I'm terrible at these things.
You're a bad yogi.
I'm a bad Instagram yogi.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be a part of this. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you for asking me. That really meant a lot.
Oh, good. I'm honored.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. You will find links to some of the topics that we covered in the show notes on the website, yogamat.com. mountaintop.chat. If you did enjoy the episode, the most valuable way that you can show your appreciation is by spreading the word. You can share the episode in whatever social media you utilize. You can give a review or a rating wherever you listen to the episode. You can subscribe to the podcast so that new episodes will automatically download. And you can follow us on our social media by searching for Chats from the Mat. A special thanks to 13 Hands for giving us permission to use their song Big Love in the opening and closing of the episode. You can learn more about 13 Hands by going to their website, which is the number 13, the word hands.bandcamp.com. I would like to thank Zoe for providing the introduction. You can find a link to her information in the show notes. Thank you for joining us at Chats from the Mat, yoga-inspired conversations with me, Brian McRae Davis. Listen up, gather round. Tell your friends I'm coming to town. I'm selling love, I'm peddling compassion. Just basic decent human interaction.